Good morning. My name is Lynn, and I'll be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Copenhagen Briefing Conference Call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there'll be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. Ms. Susie Emmerling with Center for American Progress, you may begin your conference.
Thank you, Lynn. My name is Susie Emmerling. I'm on the communications team here at Center for American Progress. I'd like to give my contact information at the start of the call in case anybody has any follow-up questions. My phone number is 202-481-8224, and my email address is semmerling with two M's at americanprogress.org. Today's call is a Copenhagen briefing, Getting to Yes. We are featuring Andrew Light and Joe Rome, the editor of climateprogress.org. I'd like to start by introducing Andrew Light.
Andrew. Hi, everyone, and greetings from Copenhagen. As Susie said, my name is Andrew Light. I'm a senior fellow, and I've been coordinating the work of the Center for American Progress on international climate policy here at the Copenhagen meeting. I think that as a veteran of these meetings, I'll just give you a little bit of what it feels like on the ground in comparison to some previous meetings of this particular climate summit, and then talk about the preliminary results of the report that we released today on our what we call our carbon cap equivalent project. In terms of how it feels here on the ground, the second Tuesday of these 2 weeks meetings is always one that I would sort of characterize as bringing a sense of nervous anticipation. What's basically happened here is that you've had a week and a couple days of very intense negotiations by essentially the real experts on climate change who are looking at the nitty-gritty of the various agreements. We're talking about the best ways of counting certain kinds of emissions and the best architecture for an international treaty. Very, very technical stuff. And also a lot of back and forth, a lot of sort of grandstanding, a lot of atmospherics, trying to basically raise the profile of every country in relationship to their home audiences who might be reading about this in the paper or watching it on television. But the nervous anticipation of a day like today, really, is because we're headed up to the ramp up to the end of the conference at the end of the week on Friday. And so this is really the last day that the climate negotiators from all the different member nations in the 192 countries that are represented here are about to turn over the reins to their climate ministers, to the environment ministers around the world, who are going to converge and then take up the critical task of taking the next step to the very important end game when the heads of state, over 90 heads of state, will arrive here by Friday, including President Obama. So you've got basically these different tiers of people really wanting to be able to deliver the goods so that when their boss shows up, they can say, we're about there, we've got a deal, rather than having to say, well, we haven't been able to be there, and so it's going to be your job to fix it. So it's a really interesting scene here. At every meeting that I've ever been to, and I've been to about eight of these meetings, you always also hear, you know, lots of stories about how nothing's happening, nothing's getting done, and there's been no lack of stories of that sort about this particular Copenhagen meeting, especially given the high hope that it plays in the history of these meetings. I would say that there has been some real progress at these meetings. It's the kind of progress that you have to kind of know what's going on here to see it happen. In terms of the treaty language itself, one of the two sort of working groups that works on treaty language for a new climate treaty came up out with some very interesting proposals last Saturday. They were continued with a second draft that came out this Tuesday, demonstrating that there is work there. There is certainly a lot of back and forth as well. And I would say that another big sign of progress has been the sense that the pledge that President Obama made at the Beijing summit in November, that he would focus this meeting on the first of a two-step process, that what we would try to do here at Copenhagen is get an interim short-term agreement that would essentially be in effect until 2012, and then by the time this convention happens again in Mexico City in December 2010, you would have the architecture and the agreement across the board for a fully final ratifiable agreement, which will eventually replace the agreement in the Kyoto Protocol. There's lots of details there on whether the one treaty will continue and another will be added on to it, and I'm happy to talk about that in the question and answer period if you're interested. The second thing in which I'd say there's really been quite a lot of progress, well, in terms of coming up with an interim agreement, is that we are moving forward towards more secure agreements on short-term financing. The president announced his commitment a week ago last Friday that the United States would support a pledge for $10 billion a year in assistance for poorer countries, developing countries, to get onto a low-carbon pathway. There has been progress there. There have been demands to do more for certain, but in terms of what the president laid out as the agenda of this meeting, there has been progress there. And we saw effectively the ways in which this is not just across-the-board funding, but very directed money that's being talked about. So yesterday, an additional sum of money was laid out by Secretary Chu from the Energy Department when he came here, and he rolled out the plan for an international fund really going after energy poverty, providing clean energy to the poorest of the poor for a total of $350 million, which the U.S. contribution would be $85 million. And then a whole array of cooperative agreements with developed and developing countries on particular sectors of technology cooperation, so things like sequestering carbon from coal-fired plants, solar power, wind power, marine power was actually added to that, so tidal and waves, and a lot of things that have not been on the agenda here before. The report that we released today, I'll just say a few words about, which is up on the Center for American Progress website now, called Counting the World's Capacity for Emission Reduction, Preliminary Data from CAP, Carbon Cap Equivalent Project. These are the beginning numbers of a project that we've been working on with Project Catalyst, that some of you will know, a modeling firm that plays a very important role in these negotiations, on essentially highlighting different ways in which we can count how different countries are making contributions to reducing their emissions. The way that I sort of put it in the column is that here at Copenhagen, and it's never been different at any of these other international meetings on climate change, you often have a lot of charges and countercharges of one party or another about no one really doing their part, that developed countries aren't doing enough in terms of reducing their emissions, developing countries aren't doing enough to reduce their emissions. And what we tried to do in this report is really do a comprehensive analysis of what everybody's been doing to demonstrate that, in fact, if the world's 17 largest economies now did everything that they said at the national level in terms of reducing their emissions, they were to do everything. This includes things like the United States getting something like the Waxman-Markey bill through the Senate and then signed by the president. If everyone did everything current and pending in terms of their emissions reduction targets, then the globe, in terms of the global scene, we would be 65% of the way towards what we believe is the target to limit a temperature rise over pre-industrial levels to only 2 degrees Celsius over those pre-industrial levels. And the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has said that's really what you got to look for. Don't let temperature go up any more than 2 degrees. The Obama administration and the G8 nations embraced this target at the July summit in Italy. And what we are doing with this research is to show that, in fact, country by country, developed and developing countries, as you go through the list, you add it all up, if everyone does what they say they're going to do, then we are 65% of the way there. Now, that's a big if, obviously, because a lot of those proposals are pending. And that's essentially why you want to highlight what's so important about what you could get out of this treaty. If you can get a strong international treaty that can bind people to the commitments they're thinking about, provide the proper incentives for people to take additional, make additional emissions cuts, then we think we can get there to where we need to be by 2020, and then on the pathway to safety down the road by 2050, which is what the scientists say that we need to do. And that we break that down in terms of gigatons of carbon, and I can go through the details on that later. The final couple things that come out of this report is that if you look at the current proposals that countries are doing and the pending proposals that countries are doing, developing countries are actually at this point poised to make a bigger contribution to limiting the reductions of absolute carbon in the atmosphere, the gigatons of carbon in the atmosphere, than developed countries are willing to do it. Some of that will be done through financing, through assistance from developing countries. Some of it won't. And in that sense, we've got a very strong argument against skeptics, for example, in the United States Senate, who say that countries like China, India, Indonesia, Brazil are not doing anything. In fact, they are going to achieve significant reductions below the business as usual pathway that they would have undergone had they not done anything. And then finally, one of the big sticking points in these negotiations has been that the U.S. targets for 2020 are much too soft. President Obama said in advance of the summit that the U.S. would put on the table a cut of 17% of our emissions below 2005 levels by 2020. That's far lower than most of our allies and amounts to essentially returning to the 1990 level emissions by 2020. And 1990 is the base year that most countries use to measure their emissions reduction. Our analysis working with Project Catalyst shows that, in fact, if you look at something like the Waxman-Markey bill, there's much more in there than just the cap and trade. And once you start adding on those other things in addition to cap and trade, such as our provisions for stopping deforestation, really the number that the U.S. could put on the table is, in fact, something like 12% below 1990 levels by 2020, which is much closer to where other developed countries are headed. So with that, I'll turn it over to my colleague, Joe Rome.
Yes, hello. Well, thank you very much for calling in. Let me just make a few points from Copenhagen. I think it's important to understand that of the 13 gigatons of CO2 cuts needed by 2020, Project Catalyst has shown that three-quarters of them can be met at a net savings of $14 billion. So, I think a key point is that this is affordable, and certainly I have talked to a great many people here in Copenhagen from around the world, and one of the main messages I hear again and again is people are doing clean energy, and the technology is available now, and what is needed is the international agreement, the financing, and the price signal. The other point I wanted to make, which as Andrew says, there's just always a negative buzz because the hard work of making progress typically goes on behind the scenes, and the people who want to throw bricks or make headlines, they say what they will say. I think the key point is that President Obama is clearly committed to making a global climate deal happen. For 8 years we had an administration run by people who not only didn't want an agreement, but they actively worked to undermine the international negotiating process. So, Obama hasn't even been president a year, and I think it's clear he is committed to a climate deal. And that means, and I think this story, hasn't been well understood, but by committing to a climate deal here, by coming here, on the last day with a target in hand, which is conditional on the U.S. Senate and Congress acting, Obama is putting his prestige behind making that domestic climate bill happen. And I think that all the buzz that people have had that somehow the climate deal was dead, it's been pushed into 2010 or beyond, I think the key point is that there is a bipartisan process going on with Kerry, Graham, and Lieberman working with the administration, and for Obama to come here is a statement to the world that he is going to do what it takes to make that domestic climate bill happen and therefore make the international process work. And I think that's all I want to say. I'd be happy to answer questions with Andrew.
Thank you, Joe. Lynn, at this point we have time for a couple of questions.
At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad at this time. We'll pause for a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Your first question comes from Amy Hatter.
Hi, thanks so much for holding this call. I have a question about your expectations for Obama. You talk about it a lot, just him coming to the conference at the end rather than last Wednesday is a sign of his commitment, but what exactly should he be putting on the table for other world leaders to see that the U.S. is serious? Do you think he needs to up the emissions target by factoring in other things such as deforestation? Do you think he needs to put down a concrete number for financial contribution in addition to what Chu did yesterday?
Well, I'll take the first stab at that and then see if Joe wants to add anything. I certainly think that...
Can you say who this is really quick?
I'm sorry. This is Andrew Light speaking.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry. I certainly think that that there would be a lot of mileage if President Obama would come in and say, "I've talked about an agreement in the range of, I've talked about a commitment for 2020 reductions, as he puts it, and the quote is in the range of 17% below 2005 levels. But I think that one of the ways in which we can improve those numbers." Is if we manage to lock in, for example, the forestry provisions in Waxman-Markey in our Senate bill and get that through. And I mean, some may think that would be, too complicated a move or something like that, but I have to say that every forum that I've spoken in Copenhagen, just being able to point to facts like that really does improve people's perspective on where we are, and it could show how, especially if what this is going to be is a two-step process. Step one, an interim political agreement, and we think that's a very good idea for giving U.S. Congress and actually other countries around the world time to finish their legislation on clean energy and climate change. This would be a way we could say, if this is step one of the process, then here's a way in which we can demonstrate that we'll be able to actually improve our emissions reductions by the time we get to step two, by the time we actually lock in a climate treaty. So I think that would be something very positive. In terms of financing, my view is what the administration will do is to stick to their guns, which is that the financing packages we're talking about the deal are in are ramp-up quick-start financing and not this more ambitious midterm financing that, for example, Gordon Brown has been talking about. And frankly, I think that it would – I think there's you want to make the people at Copenhagen happy and get forward and do a deal. You also don't want to do anything which is going to harm the hopes of getting climate legislation through the U.S. Senate. And so I think that the play the president is making about sticking to the dollars that he can actually deliver right now is the right thing. You might see something, on the sidelines. You might see some more money in terms of an international forestry commitment. I've heard that there's something like that in the works. That could definitely be announced, but I think that we're pretty much where we are in financing.
Thank you. Can we take the next question, please, Lynn?
Your next question comes from Amanda DeBarge.
Yeah, I was wondering, is there anything that happened this week or last week that surprised you? And if you could maybe elaborate on maybe both the good things that came out of the negotiations and also some of the things that have happened that you think could stall the process.
You want to start on that one, Joe, and then I can join in?
No, you start, and then I'm sorry.
Okay, sure. I'm sorry, we're not in the same room. Again, this is Andrew Light. I was surprised at the theatrics last week about the first draft of the Danish proposal of what this interim treaty would look like when it was talked about on the floor. Here at the meeting the middle of last week, the very strong reaction of the developing countries umbrella organization, which is called the G77, against this, the claims that they had never seen this before, that this was a complete shock to them. And I thought that was just really bad form in a number of ways, because it just wasn't true. They had actually seen copies of this. This wasn't anything secret. President Obama and President Hu of China both talked about the importance of this two-step process of this interim agreement at the Beijing summit last November. So that was a sort of a negative surprise, and I was very glad to see that the resolution of that was that it didn't get very much traction at the end of the day. In terms of a positive surprise, I think that the addition of extra money that's been put on the table in these smaller sectors has been a very good development. When President Obama announced the pledge would be to a $10 billion fund for which the U.S. would make, in the language of the press release, something like an appropriate contribution. I didn't expect that there would actually be any more dollars that were talked about other than that. And in fact, there were. In fact, this technology assistance project that Secretary Chu talked about was, in fact, an addition to the whatever contribution we'll make to that $10 billion. It's from existing appropriations. It's really a redirect of existing appropriations. And I thought it played very well in terms of demonstrating to the world that, I mean, there's a bad narrative here that the entire world is waiting on the votes of a couple senators. And the administration has done everything possible to clearly deliver with daily messages by some of its top cabinet officials, by Salazar, by Vilsack, by Gary Locke, by Administrator Lisa Jackson, that this administration is making progress by itself while the Senate is getting its job. I think that's an absolutely valuable message to be pushing out here.
Joe, would you like to add anything to that?
No, I think that's fine. No.
Okay, next question, please, Lynn.
Our next question comes from Renee Scoff with McClatchy Newspapers.
Hi, thanks. I just wondered what either of you make with some of the criticism I've been reading, looking at a press release from Global Forest Coalition, saying that if you don't have stronger emission cuts from the U.S., the forest protection is rather meaningless. Climate will just warm up and hurt forests. And also they see it's a big loophole if RED is funded through offsets. What do you make of that?
Well,
Andrew Lighty. Go ahead, Joe, please.
Well, first off, the U.S. targets for 2020, I think we have a very good idea what Congress is going to do, and President Obama has already said what he's coming to the table with. I think it's very important not to see the 2020 target as what determines whether we're going to stabilize at 2 degrees centigrade, 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. That's just not the case. It would be great if the U.S., Congress could make a stronger emissions reduction in 2020, but the fact of the matter is what really matters is that the rich countries make a significant reduction over the next 10 years. And more importantly, the rapid rate of reduction after 2020 and what Obama is bringing to the table, what Congress is I think, poised to enact, is pretty sharp reductions down to the 83% reduction by 2050 levels. By 2050, that's what gets you to the 2C target. Just narrowly, I think the focus on the U.S. 2020 target is a mistake. It is very clear that we can stabilize at necessary levels on the path that the U.S. is prepared to go toward. The House climate bill, and I am very hopeful that the final climate bill does not funds deforestation efforts to stop deforestation separately from offsets and separately from the domestic emissions reductions. The Waxman-Markey bill, has 720 million tons annually of reductions from stopping deforestation funded by sale of allowances separately, and I hope that is the way the final deal is cut. So I think it is not true to say that the U.S. is going to fund international efforts to stop deforestation through offsets. I certainly hope that the final deal doesn't do it that way.
Thank you. We have time for one more question, Lynn.
Your final question comes from Jim Matavalli with CPS Interactive.
Yeah, I wanted to bring up the whole verification thing. Apparently, according to today's Times, there's a impasse between the U.S. and China over verification. The U.S. says that China has to verify. China says it will not allow third-party verification. It seems kind of obvious that country, if they're just talking about carbon intensity, they could just say, well, we had greater economic activity, therefore we met our target, and be very hard without verification to say that that wasn't the case. I just wanted to get any of you to talk about how important it is that whatever claims countries make gets verified.
Well, this is Andrew Light. I think that verification is at the very heart of getting beyond the architecture of the Kyoto Protocol, which, as most of us know, required reductions from developed countries and not from developing countries. And the deal that was struck in Bali in 2007, the deal that was signed by the Bush administration, was that developing countries would eventually agree to emissions reduction that would be measured, reported, and verified, and so this is absolutely essential. Now there is different interpretations of what exactly was meant by that language of the Bali Action Plan, but I think that is one of the crucible points that we're going to have to move forward. The position I think that we're seeing right now is not unlike many of these meetings that I've seen, which is essentially a lot of sort of, you know, refusal to budge on very traditional talking points and very traditional positions until the very end of this meeting. And I don't think we're really going to know what China is willing to accept on measuring, reporting, and verification. And in fact, what the world is willing to accept on the stronger issue of compliance. What do you do if someone doesn't do what they've claimed they're going to do in terms of an emission reduction? We're not going to see what that's going to look like until the very end of this meeting. But I think it would be very strange if China did not agree to a rigorous approach to measuring, reporting, and verifying reductions, because they agreed in the Beijing summit in November to a comprehensive carbon inventory that the United States will assist them in doing. And these are two very important developments. The United States announced in the UN climate summit, at the opening of the UN in September, that we are going to do a comprehensive carbon inventory, looking, you know, an inventory of all the sources of carbon and amounts of carbon from every source in the United States over a certain amount. China has now committed to do the same thing. And you don't do that kind of inventory unless you do it as a precondition for measuring, reporting, and verifying, because that provides you the baseline so you can know when you made progress. So I think that in that bilateral agreement is, I think, an indication that China and the U.S. will actually get to the same conclusion on this in the end.
Thank you. Do either of you have any final thoughts before we close the call? Joe or Andrew?
Joe?
No, I just think that again, you know, Copenhagen is a two-step. You know, the biggest emitters said Copenhagen would be the first step of a two-step process to reach a final global deal next year. And sandwiched between that is passage of a bipartisan climate and clean energy bill. And, everything that I see here in Copenhagen says that we are on track to do that.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for calling in today. Thank you, Andrew Light and Joe Rome, for calling in from Copenhagen. We know you guys are busy out there. Again, my contact information is semerling@americanprogress.org, or my phone number is 202-481-8224. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This concludes today's conference. You may now disconnect.